Blog Talk Radio.
Let me tell you about something new. A new show called G's Power.
G's Power.
Real talk for real saints.
Are you ready?
And it's for real.
Welcome to G's Power Hour, live every weekday at 11:30 a.m. on Never Had It So Good Entertainment Network. Your host, G, will bring you informative and entertaining guests and a variety of topics in a way that you can absorb and enjoy. Listen in weekdays and call in at 516-387-1944. We love interaction. All shows can be downloaded if you miss one or found on iTunes the next day. G's Power Hour is powered by Never Had It So Good Sports Media Network.
G's Power Hour.
Yeah.
Well, good morning, brothers and sisters, kings and queens, angels and saints, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thank you so much for being with us today. I am still, I am still feeling like weeping today because I saw that video again of the last breaths of George Floyd yesterday, and it just has not left me. But we're going to get an update on the trial and everything Chauvin and Floyd today with our civil rights attorney who's back with us from Anderson and Welch in South Central Florida. This is Kevin Anderson. Good morning, Mr. Anderson. How are you, sir?
Good morning. Good morning, G. I'm fine.
I guess I should
Thank
say
you.
Southeast Central Florida, yeah. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for inviting me back again. I appreciate you remembering our firm when you're thinking about the events of the day.
Well, I appreciate you taking time out. You know, in your profession, time is kind of money. So, you know, we got to recognize that. So, I tell you, Kevin, it's just, I'm you know, trying to be non-biased or trying to be objective when you see that video is, for me anyway, is so difficult. But let's put on our adult glasses and take a look at this case and take a look at what's going on with the trial. Yesterday was the first day with the opening statements. So give us your perspective and insight and things that we should have taken away from what happened yesterday.
Well, you're putting on glasses, and I had to put on goggles. As you stated, what we saw on the video was disturbing. It's disturbing for his family. It's disturbing for the general public viewing the video. Certainly, I'm sure that will be disturbing and has been disturbing for the jurors in the particular case who are now charged with making a decision concerning the continued innocence or the guilt for Derek Chauvin. The law enforcement community as well, I believe, they are, too are experiencing so many emotions from what they have now seen and what they know and bring to the equation. You know, keep in mind that as they walk in our community, they are a symbol of justice, and they are a symbol of what took place with Mr. Floyd at the hands of Derek Chauvin. There are people who will victimize law enforcement. There are people who will call upon these men and women to answer questions about what did and did not happen and what should and should not happen going forward. They carry a lot of weight on their shoulders. They have families. They have important positions in their respective communities that require them to answer those difficult questions. So I think everybody is now shouldering what we're experiencing today. Particularly, though, let's go into the opening day. As we had indicated when we last spoke last week, there were pending motions. One in particular had to deal with the subjective intent of Mr. Floyd when he encountered law enforcement on the date that he was taken into custody. And the motion sought to limit or to prevent the prosecution and also the defense from giving an opinion about what was on Mr. Floyd's mind. Now, the state filed what is known as a motion in limine in order to allow that issue to be considered. And what a motion in limine does is it is a presentation of what you want to prevent the jury from considering or even hearing in a particular case. Obviously, that motion is done outside the presence of the jury. So the court ruled on the motion as follows, that neither the state or the defense could talk about what was on Mr. Floyd's mind, but rather they would be limited to eliciting testimony concerning their observations, which consisted of things regarding characteristics which were consistent with drug or alcohol usage, behavior, and perhaps medical symptoms, which were obvious, in that as long as the witnesses and the evidence addressed what was seen and not the motivating causes, the court would allow that particular evidence in the case. That was essentially what the motion consisted of and what the trial court ruled on and is now the marching order of the day. Okay. So.
And I'm listening. And in fact, what I was trying to do is look up that motion in limine information, and I have posted that on the G's Power Hour Facebook page in case anybody wants to kind of dig into it a little bit more. So anyway,
it's
go
pretty
ahead.
Routine. It's pretty routine. Every trial wants to kind of keep out or let in certain things, and it's a tactic that all practitioners use in order to set the rules of the game so that you kind of know what you can say, what you can't say during opening statements. You kind of know which witnesses, which evidence to use, and it's commonly deadline of maybe a week or two prior to the commencement of the trial to permit the parties to get themselves together so that they know how to conduct the proceedings once the trial commences.
Okay. All right. So, I guess I was thrown off because I really wasn't expecting when they did opening statements yesterday. I wasn't expecting the video to be right there immediately, but I guess that was what was used by and I have to remember that it's the prosecution. When I say defense, I'm thinking about, and I have to change my mindset because my thing is defending George Floyd and George Floyd's case, but the defendant is Derek Chauvin. So, so I have to kind of change my perspective. But anyway, the video threw me again. I don't know why. I just didn't expect it this soon. How much does the video set the tone for the trial?
The video is the primary evidence in the trial to show Mr. Chauvin's intent to do harm to Mr. Floyd. It's being used to evaluate the reasonableness of force that was utilized in order to subdue Mr. Floyd, and which ultimately resulted in his injuries and demise. It also shows a lack of concern and a lack of caution with respect to life when Mr. Floyd was struggling and you could hear him gasping for air and the bystanders were pleading for Derek Chauvin to get off of his neck. You've got this blood-curdling scene that's right out of a horror movie that causes a lot of emotion, and it causes people to some of us are angered, some of us are tearful, some of us are just looking at this in awe, not believing that we're watching a 21st century police officer manhandle a human being and his colleagues, allowing it to happen, and also assisting in the manhandling, which resulted in Mr. Floyd's death. So that was a powerful tool used by the prosecution in the opening statement. You don't see a lot of prosecutors or defense lawyers using what is known as demonstrative evidence in openings where the cases aren't major crimes or capital offenses. Now, oftentimes, the openings are used as an object to set up the basic scene for the jurors and to introduce them to the core disputes in a particular case, and also to give the other side the jurors a general roadmap of where the case is intended to go. But as a matter of tactic and strategy, opposing counsel tries to limit what is said in opening statement, because what you're doing is you're forecasting what you're going to do. And the other side is listening and watching and making copious notes so that they can stop you in your tracks. So there's a balance there concerning how much information you're going to give, and also the balance is to strategically allow the other side to kind of get the essence of where you're going without, you know, showing your entire hand. So
I can't imagine being a juror, though, having to sit there through that and having, I would say, probably having to suppress some raw emotion in watching that. If you're anyone with any type of heart or conscience, because you're still supposed to, that's not supposed to be just it. You have to sit there through that whole month-long trial and kind of weigh everything. But I can't imagine out the gate the first day trying to sit there and act like, well, this is not affecting me. This is just evidence. This is just, information.
But it's not evidence. And there is a jury instruction which either precedes opening statements or is given to the jurors following the opening statement, which states that, ladies and gentlemen, what you're hearing is not evidence. It is a prediction, a forecast of what the parties believe the evidence will show. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if either party goes too far and begins to state their opinions, or they don't precede the argument by, ladies and gentlemen, the evidence will show, oftentimes an objection will be made, which will more likely than not be sustained in order for counsel to be reined in. So it's not, that's not evidence.
Okay. Gotcha. But still.
But still, we hear it.
But still.
Yep.
All right. It's not evidence, but the part I could watch and the part they did show, because I'm assuming some of what I saw, they were fast forwarding through some of this for time's sake. Was that the case?
Yes, they were highlighting certain aspects of the video which would complement the state's case and seem to be streamlined. So, what did you think about the prosecutor, in his opening? Did he seem to be dynamic, or did he seem to be kind of like, reading from like a script? Did you expect the state to come out of the box with that type of presentation. What did you think you were going to see yesterday, G?
To be honest, I wasn't sure. I think it was calculated. I think it was reined in a little bit. You know, I think they had to kind of strike a balance between, you know, that this is, you know, this is a really passionate type of case and how it impacted the country and everything like that. I think they had to strike a balance between all of that emotion that has that's going into this from the beginning, from, you know, family, protesters, whatever the case may be, having to take all of that in and go into that and just kind of be almost, I'll say almost because I don't think it was totally that way, but I just would say almost matter of fact about, you know, this is what we're presenting, this is what I want you all to know, and this is how we plan on, I guess, proceeding and everything. I just felt that it was balanced. I think it was somewhat restrained. You're asking me whether or not I think more should have been done with the opening statement from the prosecution.
No, I just wanted to get your overall perspective of, you know, how the delivery was made and, you know, what his deportment consisted of. You know, typically when you start a race, you know, you put your, you know, if it's going to be a relay, you put the fastest man, you know, on, you know, in the number one slot, and he just jets out mm-hmm. of the chalks, you know, and, you know, gets the team moving and shaking. Depending
right.
on what's going on. But, you know, I thought that he did a very credible job. Yeah, you know, he
mm-hmm.
didn't over-sensationalize the case.
Right.
And, you know, he had a script and he had a pace that he wanted to go with so that methodically he marched you through the roadmap. His delivery, I thought, was sort of even throughout the whole thing. You know, he wasn't preaching. Sometimes
mm-hmm.
you know, you'll have, you know, prosecutors who will be a little preachy. You know, he wasn't so melodramatic until, you know, you just kind of, you know, had to ignore the delivery.
Right.
I liked the fact that he was kind of anchored and, you know, tethered to the script, so to speak. And so what about the defense? Do you think the defense lawyer's general reply in his opening statement was responsive and that it was, you know, met the prosecutor's theories adequately?
And let me just be fair and be clear. I did not see the whole thing, but I did see it. I thought he was okay. I didn't see him as. Let me just put it this way. To me, if I had to do a score and walk away in terms of who won the day, it wasn't necessarily a landslide, but I think the prosecution won the day. So, however, I do have to say, the case was made for some other things to be considered in terms of why the police response was the way it was. You know, although someone bottom lined it yesterday or this morning or whatever, George Floyd died basically for $20. You know, when you boil it down, that's basically what it seems like. You know, George Floyd died over $20. You know, but when you boil it down, as I'm saying, I think it kind of leans more toward the prosecution. However, like I said, there were things that I thought were brought to light that I, you know, some of them I didn't know about, some of them I did, you know, to talk about, you know, where George Floyd was in the first place before it got to that point, things about what happened in the police car, you know, other things that were talked about in terms of like you had mentioned before, previous this year, one commentator talked about, well, you know, it's also going to possibly be a matter of tolerance in terms of what he's able to tolerate. You know, if it's something that he's accustomed to handling, then it may not be a factor, possibly, in what happened. But I know you did mention about how the whole thing with the drugs might play a bigger role than we think.
And I'm going to address that today. You typically take breaks. So can I go for a little while here, or am I in jeopardy of a break here?
Oh, no, well, you got about 10 minutes because we're going to let you go for the first half. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. So
unless you need to take a break. So.
No, I don't. Okay. So ultimately the prosecutor gave his rendition of what happened, I think, in order to kind of move people emotionally, in order to set up the possibility of a aggression that triggered the death of George Floyd. He kind of skipped over some stuff, which I thought, you know, he should have addressed head on, because sometimes when you don't mention things, it looks like you're hiding something, or you're not highlighting things that are going to come out eventually, which are harmful to your case. And transparency is important when you're asking a jury to make a finding that's going to result in a person probably going to prison for a while. For example, the whole encounter at that store prior to Mr. Floyd being arrested by the officers, where apparently he was sitting in a car, and it looked like he was ingesting more pills or some type of substance, and there was some surveillance video which apparently captured that. That had never been discussed. I had not heard about that prior to yesterday, and that is something that I think is going to play out at some point in the trial itself. The prosecutor stating that once they finally did get Mr. Floyd subdued, that he stated that he couldn't breathe 27 times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is something that I think jurors are going to not forget, because, you know, 27 times, I can't think of anything that I've said 27 times in the same day. You know, mm-hmm. You hear his that blood curdling voice as things are going, you know,
mm-hmm.
The interaction with law enforcement. And the prosecutor shapes the respirations as being like shallow, and the words being further and further apart, and his voice getting heavy, and then
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden no movements. It's still climactic
mm-hmm.
until like you're on the edge of your seat thinking, wow. And then he talks about something known as these agonal breathing tones, which essentially would be gasping of air, and these anoxic seizures, which kind of trigger these involuntary muscle reactions, because things are happening to your organs inside.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I believe, the touchstone for the government being able to argue that the aggressive nature of contact with Derek Chauvin and the other officers triggered cardiac arrest. There's no way that you would have this anoxic seizure-like symptom and this deep breathing and this repeated, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. Unless something
mm-hmm.
is more likely than not happening, which is distressful, and something which would definitely be attributed to some organ reaction which could cause death, even if you consider the ingestion of the meth and the fentanyl. Then the reflection that Mr. Floyd has when he's down on the pavement. You know, he's calling for his mother. He's telling folks to tell his children that he loves them. And then, you know, he's saying, listen, you know, my stomach hurts. My neck hurts. And then the last thing he says is,
everything hurts. You know,
everything hurts.
Someone was talking, there was some commentary, because I was listening to some other people that were discussing it, and someone was trying to explain about why, you know, they were telling him, you know, to be still and stuff like that. Someone tried to explain, you know, they had him pancake down on the pavement, and if he's trying to breathe, then he needs room for his diaphragm to expand and contract, and there was no room for him to really have that, and that's why he was trying to move so that he could get some way to get air in and out of his system properly.
Well, he was moving. He kept moving his shoulder up so that he could somehow, like, you know, expand, you know, I believe his lungs, or allow his lungs to expand, rather, to breathe. Chauvin's knee was on the other shoulder. You know, what was particularly aggravating, and I thought masterfully presented, was the knee remaining against his neck after the officers could not find a pulse. Then when the ambulance attendants arrived, the knee stayed on the neck while he was motionless. Then even after
he was motionless for a long time,
the knee was still on the neck. The knee stayed on the neck until the stretcher was parallel to Mr. Floyd, and the knee just could no longer continue to be depressing the neck. That right there evinces intent, and I think that was probably the death nail with respect to a closing statement when you are forecasting intent. Right there, series of events that was portrayed by the prosecutor, I thought was masterful.
The fact that people kept saying, check his pulse, you all need to check his pulse, and no one was checking, doing at least that, you know, checking his pulse. There was none of that. It was, for me, it was hard, you know, just average layperson. It was just hard to watch, because even though I may not be medically trained or whatever, there was a point where I'm like, why is this man's knee still on this other man's neck? Because this man is obviously gone. It was just obvious.
There was a first responder there. There was a first responder there, Ms. Genevieve Hansen. She was there on scene, and she told them that she was a first responder. And they prevented her from helping. And when she moved forward to help, Derek Chauvin pulled out, or he reached for his mace. They were going to mace her if she tried to help. They were preventing people from helping him even after he was motionless and defenseless and could not do anything that would have been harmful to the officers or himself or our bystanders. You know, so and that hurt them tremendously.
Right. I'm just trying to imagine. To me, that just says there is so. You know, I'm not a juror. I'm not anything. But to me, it's just, as a Christian, I'm saying, how is there that much hate in your heart that you have no kind of compassion for this man? You would probably treat a dog better than you have been treating this man with your knee on his neck for this whole time. I can't fathom it at all.
Well, let's now balance it. And you're talking about fathoming some rational response to what took place. You're not expected to be okay with what happened. No one is. the defense in the case.
Yeah. The thing I'm talking about. Apparently he was. He didn't see an issue with leaving his knee on this man's neck for 9.5 minutes.
Well, now, what is interesting is that, you know, as the trial goes on, I am looking for the possibility of Mr. Chauvin to take the witness stand on his own behalf to say, listen, my knee, the defense is not doing such a terrible job right now. They are working with what they have. And now, can you imagine Derek Chauvin saying, listen, my knee was against his neck, but I wasn't pressing on his neck after he was motionless. I was just there just in case. How do you combat that? How do you come back in and say, well, yeah, we know you were pressing down. If he says, no, I was just resting on top of his neck. Suppose he takes the witness stand and says that. What do you do? How do you respond to that?
One thing you have to get, you have to get a professional to say possible that he was just resting on his neck. How, you know, based on the way his body, his posture was in terms of how his body weight was distributed, is it possible that he could have just been resting his knee, or was his weight on this man's neck?
Well, I think that this case is going to boil down to expert testimony regarding causation and the cause of death. And, you know, they got to deal with this. And so far, it's been addressed and, you know, kind of tap danced around. You know, the state, you know, says, listen, you know, there are five causes of death, you know, natural, accidental, suicidal, homicidal, and undetermined. So, like, this wasn't like any of the four. Other than homicide. And a homicide means that you died at the hand of others. So therefore, it must be Derek. Well, okay, I hear you. But, like, tell me why his heart stopped. Because your own pathologist did not say that he died because of asphyxiation. Your own witness. There's nothing more powerful than opposing counsel using your witness to prove their defense. No one's going to come in and say that he died because he was strangled to death or there's asphyxiation. They're going to say asphyxiation happened, but they're going to say that the asphyxiation triggered a cardiac arrest. So I need to hear that. And I didn't hear that yesterday. I don't know whether you heard that. And I think that the sooner the state, you know, comes to terms with what we're going to hear instead of what they would like us to believe, the better, you know, we're going to be. Because Kevin Anderson and Gretchen Dentz are not on that jury. Don't forget that. There are other people on the jury who see what is happening. They hear it a different way. And they're asking, like, okay, well, man, prove it. Bring it. If you got it, bring it. Okay? If you're saying that, like, the knee on the neck caused them to die, bring it. So I need to hear a pathologist say that. The defense was interestingly pointed when they said that, listen, you know, there were no telltale signs of death by asphyxiation. They put it out there. They basically called the state's bluff. They said that the blood gas exchange showed exceptionally high levels of carbon dioxide, that there was no petechial hemorrhaging. And for those who don't know what petechial hemorrhaging is, it is when the capillaries in the eyes begin to rupture based on pressure resulting from things like asphyxiation, that there was no evidence of that. In addition, there was a femoral blood draw, which showed lethal amounts of meth and fentanyl in Mr. Chauvin's blood. Now, the government says, the state said, well, for most people, that could have been lethal. But not for Mr. Floyd, because Mr. Floyd was an addict, and Mr. Floyd had a tolerance. Well, A, that certainly doesn't make the jury like Mr. Floyd any better. And B, what you're kind of saying is that, you know, it was enough to kill a man, but not him because he was a drug addict. But, like, there was enough to kill a man. Well, when you couple that with the fact that he had heart disease, and in addition to the heart disease, that there was, I believe he also had a pelvic tumor or something that was causing him some problems, and there was some other thing that they had mentioned which caused like adrenaline or something like that to be more concentrated with him than other folks. You're kind of thinking, well, wait a minute, man, was it asphyxiation or was it something else? So, like, you know, this case is going to boil down to the experts coming in and giving testimony about how he died. That's where I think this whole case is going to go. I don't care who comes in there and says what everybody else saw. We have a video. Okay, we have a video. And, you know, sure, we got, you know, Gene Scurry, the 911 operator who, like, is shocked and appalled and calls, you know, for a supervisor because she's seeing something which is inconsistent with police practices. And we've got this other lady, Alicia Euler, I think her name was. She was the Speedway employee who took the videos that have been shown all over the world. And then now on the stand, we've got Donald Williams II, who was the black witness, the man who's like calling these officers all these names, and, you know, he's like, you know, trained in martial arts, and, you know, he's standing right there and he's giving some testimony. That's important. Those are predicate witnesses. Those are fact witnesses, but they are not practitioners and they cannot establish causation. We need causation witnesses to come in there, pathologists to tell us, okay, this is what happened, and because of what happened, this is why he died. We got to hear that.
And speaking of one eyewitness, I want to ask you about one eyewitness when we get back, but we are going to take a break. Thanks for talking for as long as you did, but we've got to take a break, but we'll come back. We are here with civil rights attorney Kevin Anderson of Anderson Welsh. This is G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. If you have questions for Kevin, the number is 516-387-1944. That is 516-387-1944. G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Networks. We'll be right back.
Over the past 60 years, Dove Beauty Bar's superior formula has remained unchanged. But when it comes to beauty, everything changed. Together, we redefined beauty. We said no to stereotypes and yes to every type. We let go of judgments and embraced what makes us unique. We're proud to have been there with you, caring for you every step of the way. Here's to the next 60 years.
Hi, I'm Tim Garrison. You may know me as Timmy G. Yeah, I know. It's been 2 decades, but I want you to know I'm back in the Arglitex. And I've got a mix of music that can help you relax and chill out. It's smooth. It's relaxing. It's chill out jazz. The soulful mix of smooth jazz, soul, and smooth R&B. So join me every Wednesday night, 10 p.m. to midnight on K-Ham Radio.
Are you chilling?
Good afternoon. Welcome back to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. We are here with civil rights attorney Kevin Anderson of Anderson & Welsh. We are talking about the Derek Chauvin trial, who is he's the man accused of the murder of George Floyd. And what I want to ask you, Kevin, is about what about the mixed martial artist? And the reason I ask about that person is because when you're talking about holes and stuff, for example, I would assume that he would have some, even though he's not, a medical practitioner, he would still have some insight in terms of what kind of hold that was that, or what type of pressure it causes, you know, to do somebody's bodily harm, fatal injury. How important, or is his testimony, would his testimony be of any importance in this case?
His testimony is important as a fact witness, but not as an expert witness. He cannot come in to this trial to give an opinion regarding police practices and the use of force. But what he could do and did do was testify about what he saw. Yesterday, he is the reason why the jurors got a hour head start to their homes because the trial court excused the jury and allowed the parties to kind of like go back and reconstitute a little, because I think Mr. Williams was getting a bit afar from his role as a fact witness in the particular case. You know, so yeah, I saw that he was a longtime mixed martial artist, but that's not why you're there, to talk about moves and maneuvers and things of that nature. So, and you know, so he needs to kind of curtail that and to testify about what he saw. And also keep in mind that he interjected himself by saying a number of expletives and being somewhat assertive on this you know at the scene, and he was there watching particularly what was happening. So we know that, you know, you think you and I were emotional yesterday watching this like a year later? He saw it, you know, so he's going to come there and he's going to pack a bang. So I think, you know, you get him up there, you let him say what he saw, and you get him out of there, get him out of the room, you know, and that's about it for him.
Okay. I was just curious because I'm figuring that even though he's only there as an eyewitness, isn't there something that's going to stick in someone's mind that, you know, yeah, he was just, you know, he was just happened to be there, but maybe he has some additional credibility because of his experience.
I would have never allowed him to even testify about that. If I were the defense, I would have filed a motion in limine to prevent him from giving any of that testimony and to prevent the opposing counsel from eliciting that testimony. He is not an expert witness, particular case, and if they intended to introduce him as an expert witness, they needed to disclose it, and then try to elicit that testimony as he observed what was taking place. But he is a fact witness.
Okay. I wanted to also find out or get your opinion in terms of like we were talking about before, the jurors are going home. So the jurors went home after day one. What do you think any of them actually did a little bit of additional research? Do you think any of them did any talking like they aren't supposed to? What are your thoughts in terms of the jury being compromised at this point?
Don't like the decision to not sequester the jury. I don't like the decision to permit the jury access to social media. I believe that they are going to be exposed to this trial and therefore inadmissible evidence that takes place outside of the trial, just like you and I are, and it will influence their decisions in this particular case. It's my belief that they knew they were supposed to be there yesterday until a certain time frame, and I think they know that that time was interrupted for a reason. They are curious, and their family members were tuning in just like everybody else tuned in for day one. And there's going to be some like statement to them like, hey, that guy was like, he was getting too far afield, man. They had to send you guys home. you know, and they're going to tune in to say, well, what was he saying? What don't they want us to hear? You know? So, you know, I think this is like a problem. This is going to be a problem. I wouldn't be surprised if at some point during the trial to the jury, you know, and there may be questions during the trial, just like when the settlement was announced, where they brought jurors back to ask them how they viewed that settlement. These jurors may be brought back in eventually one by one to ask, like, hey, are you listening to things? Are you seeing things? What do you think about this? We saw you, you know, over here. Something's going to happen. I guarantee you that's going to cause a juror or two to be put under the microscope. All right, so but let me go to something here in reference to what happened when George Floyd was removed from the scene. Did you catch where he went when he was taken from the scene? Something that has not previously been disclosed and which I think caught me like a right hook.
Mm-hmm. Him going to the car and what, taking a nap or something?
No.
Okay.
No. What happened was after he something known as a code 3 was given to step up the response by the responders in this particular case. And when the responders arrived, they did not begin to treat Mr. Floyd. They did something known as a load and go, which is a technique where you arrive in a contentious situation, you pick up the person, the patient, you put them on the gurney, throw them in the back of the ambulance, and you get out of there. But you don't go to the hospital necessarily. You go to another location, which is not that far away, to begin treatment measures. That's what happened in this particular case. Did you catch that testimony? You probably didn't catch that testimony. This case was a load and go.
Okay.
So dispatch was even asked about it. The witness in the particular case, what was her name? Mrs. Scurry, Jenna Scurry. She was asked about that, about this load and go. And what happened was that they took him to another location. And when he went to this other location, they apparently worked on him. And, I want to hear, why, A, you're working on someone who is supposedly deceased. B, what did you do? And how long he stayed there? I also want to know, why wouldn't the prosecutor address that? Because that's definitely something that I think is relevant in this particular case. And if I were a juror, I'd want to know, how come you didn't tell me about that, Mr. Prosecutor? Mr. Transparency, what's going on here? So was he alive? Are you telling me you're taking someone to another location to work on them after they've been deceased? Was he alive? Tell us. I want to know. It's going to be an issue. I think it's going to be an issue. And I also want to know, what time did you call to death? When was he pronounced dead? I need to know.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me. Now, was it on scene? Was it later in the hospital? Was he alive for a while? I need to know. What was going on? It's got to
right.
I think the defense, they're working with what they have, but the state is leaving some holes that I think they need to patch up pretty quickly.
Mm.
Because, again, Kevin Anderson and Gretchen Demps are not on that jury. Period. And people they want to know, what is going on here? So,
right.
So I wanted to bring that out, and I want you to stay alert for that, because it's that's going to, I think, be one of the features in the case, going back again to the experts, cause of death. How did he die? What killed him?
Time of death.
Time of death.
Time of death.
Time of death.
Time of death. That's going to be it right there.
What did you think about the family? They are not in the courtroom. The family is actually outside of the courtroom. And actually, one of the reasons given for ending yesterday's session was because the family couldn't get the feed or something, that there was some disruption to the feed where they're listening and watching the proceedings or something like that. So I caught the press conference or the statements that preceded the commencement of the motion in limine and openings yesterday, and I'm catching snippets of the family's attorney and also some of the civil rights activists who are on scene there, but I think people are relatively restrained and focused so as not to distract and to let, the lawyers do what they need to do inside the courtroom. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, like I said, I was unable to catch all of it, but, for the family not to have the access that everybody else is having, pretty much, that's that's kind of interesting. I don't know really what to make of it. And like I said, I really didn't catch all of that. But because my understanding was there was supposed to be at least one family member in during the proceedings, correct?
And I'm not saying that that family member isn't in there, and that is an interchangeable position as well. So multiple
right.
folks can trade in and trade out. But, you know, there
right.
is a literal entourage of non-family members there who
oh, yeah.
are, you know, saying that they are germane to the process, and they just, you know, they're all over the place. You know, so,
yeah.
you know, that's really not a big point, you know, for our discussion today. I just wanted to throw
mm-hmm.
it out there to see what your thoughts were, because, you know, you'll probably go back and look at it and have some thoughts and catch me offline on that one.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So, training. Mr. Chauvin's lawyer did what we predicted. He stated,
mm-hmm.
quote, that Derek Chauvin did exactly as he was trained, unquote. Interesting. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, opposing counsel says, listen, you know, he didn't do what he was trained to do. Opposing counsel says they're going to bring in the police chief to say that what happened was totally inconsistent with training, and that they're going to bring in this guy, I believe his name is David Klieger, who is the Minneapolis police, one of the trainers, to state
mm-hmm.
that the force was excessive. They're going to bring in this woman, Katie Blackwell, no relation to the prosecutor, Mr. Blackwell, to talk about the training that should have led him in another direction. So that's going to be interesting. You've got both parties saying that, you know, one thing, training was violated or what took place was inconsistent with the training, and the other party saying, no, man, we did everything that was textbook, and we're going to show you. That's going to be an interesting argument, and I'm going to be glued to the tube when that argument is presented by both parties.
Now, whether it doesn't matter how much is with training or not, because if he did something against training, yes, and then a lot of the burden is put on him. But if he did something in accordance with training, isn't that showing maybe that there's a flaw in the training?
But yeah, but the trainer isn't on trial for murder, so you know Derek Chauvin is. And if,
right.
if like there's a flaw in the training, and you go in and say, "Look, this is what you told me to do. I did." You know, it's akin to, you know, being me, like, you know, being told, "Listen, you know, give this patient, you know, 15 cc's of this drug," and I do it, and then they die, and then you know I get arrested for, you know, culpable negligence, and they say, "Yeah, you gave the patient too much of the medication," and I go, "Well, you know, Dr. Smith told me to do it. He's the, you know, this guy." You know, this guy is the chief, you know, physician here on the unit. And, like, we've been doing this for years, and he told me to do it this time. And then they go, well, I'm sorry. This was not a good experience for patients, so therefore, I don't care what Dr. Smith said. You're going to jail, and we're going to charge you with culpable negligence. I mean, that, I think, is a defense. That is a defense. That's a defense. So I think you're going to the state has to close some holes up here. The training hole and the causation hole, they need to, like, get that right and to just, you know, embrace it and give us a full-throated theory that is going to not be broken down by the defense. The defense is looking at this stuff. You know, I'm a civil rights activist and a civil rights attorney, G, but I'm also a criminal defense lawyer. Understand
mm-hmm.
that's how I started, and that's what I've been doing longer, and that's what I still do. I know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you now,
right.
they better get it together when it comes to causation and when it comes to training.
I still want to go back to the whole argument about the time of death. Isn't that going to be one of the most relevant issues with this case? I mean, if they say the time of death was around or before Derek Chauvin's knee was on the neck, you know, I mean, well, during whatever, versus, like you were saying, that load and go period, isn't that going to make a difference?
If they can show that the cardiac arrest was triggered by the aggression, which was excessive, then it would not make much of a difference. So it wouldn't matter whether there was asphyxiation on the ground that resulted in instant death or whether a belated death was triggered by the aggression from excessive force. You get to the same conclusion. The problem is that that's not being articulated. It's not very clear. They need to, like, pronounce that, enunciate it, so that the jurors understand what your theory is and not this, like, wobbly, you know, sort of, like, wonky, it could be this, and then it could be that, and if he wasn't a drug addict, it would have killed him, but he was a drug addict, and therefore, you know, it had to be this. No, man, like, embrace the theory, stick with it, and, like, prove it.
Right, I mean, it's not reassuring if there's a lot of back and forth all over the place, you know, I mean. Because it has to be something rock. This whole case has to be rock solid going forward. Because there are going to need to be decisions made after this case, and it's going to be based on the outcome of this case. There are going to be decisions needed about training. There are going to be decisions needed about determining cause of death and how you handle certain situations. Like you were talking about the load and go, should that have been handled differently, you know? And I didn't know anything about that. So that's something that's going to have to be addressed afterwards. So, I mean, the whole wavering, you need to kind of stick with something so that decisions can be made one way or the other, but without question, you know, right or wrong.
I would love to do a show with a pathologist. And one of my colleagues, a very close friend, who is the proprietor and a forensic nurse at Godoy Medical, and her specialty is asphyxiation and strangulation and choking. She is a friend of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Very, very credible. This I've never encountered an expert who could break it down better. And her name is, again, Tara Godoy, and I'm sure she would love to join us. We should get our hands on the autopsy, and if we can get a pathologist to be a part of the panel, we can just go at it and start talking medical evidence here as it relates to Mr. Floyd's death. What do you think about that?
Sounds like a plan to me. Well, we need to discuss it. We need to get it done.
All right, good.
All right. Thank you for taking the time. Dang, that went too fast. anyway, thank you for taking the time, and we'll keep in touch, and thanks for following that and pointing out the things that we need to be looking at, because, like I said, there are a couple of things that, especially that load-and-go thing, that really kind of set my antenna up in terms of wanting to find out more about that. And I'll try to see if I can find some information and post that on the G's Power Hour Facebook page. But thank you so much, Mr. Anderson. Have a very blessed day.
You're welcome.
Hey, thank you all for listening. This has been G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. Be well, be safe, be blessed, and please remember, all real power comes from God. Take care.
He'll make it all right.